Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. As always, I ask my friends to contribute to this cause, to keep me on the air and to keep me researching full time. My financial situation continues to deteriorate. For those of you who have contributed already, I thank you very much. I don't remember if I said this the last time or not, but I've gotten all my medical bills from University of Virginia, and that my insurance won't cover them because it says right in the fine print that if injuries are received in a riot or some other sort of civil unrest, they will not be covered. So I have to pay these out of pocket. Anyway, I don't have tons of time because I need to talk about Las Vegas. If anyone at this stage believes the media narrative of the Vegas shootings, you are a halfwit. You're an idiot. You're a fool. But more importantly, you need to listen. Now, I know casinos very well. My father was a big gambler. I was a gambler with him when I was younger, and I stopped doing that when I had kids. But casinos, as we all know, are one of the most secure areas on the planet. Robberies, cheaters, pickpockets, anyone. If someone gets away with stealing at a casino, no one would ever go back. They're paranoid about it. Think that bringing in 49 rifles in these long, thin bags wouldn't attract attention, where every square inch of that place is under, including parts of the bedroom, are under media surveillance by a small army of security guards, fairly armed security, well-armed security guards. It's ridiculous. The Potawatomi Casino in Wisconsin in 2013 was shot up, in Milwaukee. A man walked onto the premises with a gun. He shot a woman in the leg. He fired to the floor. I guess he was a very bad shot. And a few guys were able to jump him when he was reloading. After that, just a few years ago, security at these casino hotels went wild. They tripled, quadrupled spending because safety, everyone coming into that place has tons of cash on them. There's millions of dollars in the place. They're more secure than banks are. And in fact, banks model their own security systems on casinos. And then, of course, in Manila, just this year, a person came in and shot, I believe, 39 people. In Manila. And so within the last 3 years, you've had more than one shooting with, in one case anyway, it was over 30 in 2000. Wisconsin was in 2013. And then just this year, we have another one. And then a third one here in Vegas. Anybody bringing in luggage like that, he would be under surveillance from the minute he got out of the car, would be stopped. And one of the things that the Potawatomi shooting introduced in these casinos was any strange luggage, as a matter of policy, will be stopped and searched. Now, the AR-15 is allegedly what he was supposed to have used, the civilian version of the M-16. Now, I've shot this many times before. And he was using the standard, the civilian 223 rounds that really do very little damage over 150 yards. He was using an unmodified weapon. He had no idea how to modify anything. And actually, in the AR-15 modifications, longer barrels and everything else, takes a long time, a lot of work. And it's a specialist. And there's no one who's claiming that. So after 200 yards, 75% of the energy is spent. 500 yards, it's finished. There's no momentum at all and way off target. This guy was something like 1,300 feet away. And of course, the first thing I noticed about this thing was that the crackle of the shots was easily heard over the massive PA system of the concert. Outdoor concerts, of course, have to have far more wattage going through the speakers than if it were indoors. So this is loud. To hear that crackle above a large, very loud PA system is absurd. This guy didn't know much about guns, and no one has said otherwise. I mean, there's been times where highly modified AR-15s have shot at 800 yards. But that's not the model that he was using, and these are highly trained marksmen. This guy fired 290 rounds from a minimum of 1,200 feet, probably more than that. They would do minimal damage. Killing 60 is out of the question. The Ohio National Guard fired almost 70 rounds, very close. The protesters at Kent State in 1970 and killed only four. These guys were trained in the use of weapons. They were fighting for their lives. And were very close. Now, the Kent State shootings is yet another hoax, or another false flag, I should say, because these boys, they were mostly 18-year-old, were being pushed up against a wrought iron fence that surrounded the campus by students with bats and bricks, and they were going to kill them because they said so. They were fighting for their lives. They would not shoot except for the most extreme of circumstances. So that's a complete a false flag. The shooting there was one of these means whereby there was going to be opposition to the Vietnam War, and they needed an event. We'll get back to that here in a minute. The 223 Remington is not powerful. They call it a varmint hunter because it just doesn't have very much killing power, even at normal range. And even if you're hunting, you know, medium-sized game like deer, you have to shoot it in the head for it to do anything. You have to be right on top of them to do any serious damage. But the worst were the crisis actors. These people had just seen people dropping dead all over the place. Blood spurting everywhere. Massacre. They themselves were almost killed. And yet they're describing the event like they're giving a book report at school. Corrine Lamas is one of these people who even thought that it was proper to give her policy prescriptions about gun control after she very calmly spoke about her friends being massacred. She was also seen on Dr. Phil the previous year, depicting a narcissistic, self-obsessed woman under a different name. My favorite, though, was the blooper where the one started laughing and then very quickly reversed herself and cried and wiped away non-existent tears. Most of the crisis actors said that they were shooting for 30 minutes straight. I've heard at least two say that. They were loading bodies onto trucks. All these crisis actors all claimed to be heroes. They were in the line of fire. They all were in at safety and then went back to rescue more people, loading bodies on trucks. I can't find a picture of a body. I was too young really to be conscious about this, but in 1978, after the killings at Jim Jones' People's Temple, the next day there were pictures of bodies all over the place, huge numbers. Everyone there had a camera. Everyone there had a video recorder. And I haven't seen anything except the same one or two pictures of these people, videos of these people running around, without any blood or bodies being seen. There was a nurse, her name was Vanessa. She said, "It was my duty to get back into the area." They were all wearing stage makeup, by the way, because there were no reflections off the lights that they were using. She said, "I was at safety. I was, in a safe location, and I just felt I had to go back." She even calls herself brave about it. She tries to cry and is very, very poor. She also claimed to be loading bodies on trucks. There was at least three people I've seen who load bodies on trucks. None of these trucks, by the way, have been identified. Nurses and off-duty cops, everyone working and communicating together, she says. It's like an SNL skit depicting some over-dramatic court witness. But this nurse has been identified before. She's been in a few of these crisis things. Her names have been Alex Israel and Katie Foley. And if you remember Alex Israel, this very same person pretended to be a former classmate of Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook shooter. In that case, she's almost completely identical. But even with their fake drama, they describe the scene with perfect detail. Black man, we call him Black Superman, seems to have seen everyone in the place get shot. He'll tell you where it happened, how many bullet holes they have in their chest or in their face or whatever it is. He knows who was trampled and who wasn't. And every one of these crisis actors has been attractive and well-spoken, which is a weird coincidence. They don't even have like a facial imperfection or a zit or anything like that. They're actually very attractive people. Rob McIntosh, Mike Kronk, there were two others, all speaking calmly about the shooting they had just seen. I think it was Mike Kronk who was talking about his buddy, who didn't have a name, that he didn't have a cell phone either. He was able to carry him, bring him over a fence, and then stuff him under the stage, while this same buddy of his had three chest wounds. Yet he claimed to have stopped the bleeding, which, by the way, you need special equipment for that. And yet he called himself a hero, not caring about his safety. Then there's the giggler, which has been taken off of YouTube now. That's the only thing, the only way she's known is that she couldn't keep herself from laughing. And then there was Heather Goose, who said, I had to stay and fight and rescue people putting on more trucks. She had two dying young men in her arm. She was with them 4 hours without any kind of help. Yet I haven't seen a picture of a body or even blood. All of these can be found. Just go to YouTube and hit in crisis actor. They're all the same. They're all heroes, and they speak of their heroism in the same way. I was at a place of safety, and I ran back because something was telling me to do it. They carried people around, and a whole bunch of them were loading bodies onto trucks. No one's ever seen a truck here. They don't explain how the bleeding was ever stopped. And then they cut away to people in surgery. Generally speaking, you know, you don't bring TV cameras right after a surgical procedure. They're all still in stage makeup, these people. And they don't look like they've been in surgery. Look at these people, then look at someone who's just gotten up from surgery. They're not the same. They're smiling. They're coherent. They have like one tube stuck in their nose. Ridiculous. It's absurd. Anyone who believes that and their crazy stories of heroism is absurd. I've been fighting with people this whole time, and really, for some reason, they need to believe it. They can't believe that someone else could have caused this. Now, today is the 10th of October, and I'm agnostic as to whether it was a hoax or whether there were other people doing the shooting. I haven't seen a body. I haven't even seen blood. And I've been searching every search engine you could imagine, and I can't find any. Now, I was reading the Department of Veterans Affairs, how behavior after a trauma is actually quite predictable. One major sign, one very common sign, is refusal to talk about it. High levels of alertness, making them extremely jumpy. Nausea, inability to concentrate. These are almost universal. Fear and anxiety are the most common normal effects of trauma. And yet none of these are to be found in any of these crisis actors. I mean, it's true. Every once in a while we come across someone who can detach themselves from the trauma and talk like a normal person, but not 10 very attractive people in stage makeup. Now, there was a man, a former military man, who was not, who did not give his name, suspiciously calm. He says he was involved in offensive operations in the Army. He speaks as if he's a policeman, but he's not. And let me quote him here. The gentleman who they killed, the shooter, he's a local gentleman from Mesquite, but they've not released any details on his identity or his place of residence. He just said his identity and place of residence. He messed up. What, did he just guess where the guy was from? It was just a few minutes later that they came up with that they had the that they had actually more than a few minutes later, a couple of hours later, they released the name and the locale of the shooter. So at the time, there's no way he could have known that he was from Mesquite. But trauma is one of the more interesting psychological phenomena, because psychology today even says trauma can reset the personality. It can break it from old patterns. It can create dissociation and then be put back together again. It is the ultimate precursor to suggestibility. Suggestibility is kind of when the normal barriers of psychological manipulation have been broken down. The subject is more amenable then to different ideas. The National Edition of the Institute of Food and Agricultural Science at the University of Florida has a 1998 disaster handbook. And it's very clear in reading this thing that the crisis actors had no relation and could not have seen any of these traumas. Disorientation, they say, is one of the most common responses, immediate responses. Anxiety and fear clearly associated with that. None of these people were sweating, and none were shaking, which is often another common. It is almost certain that they were actors. Now, whether it's a hoax or a false flag, a hoax being completely false, like the Pulse shootings in Orlando, which was completely fake. No one died there. I don't believe anyone died. I don't believe that Dylann Roof killed anyone. A false flag is when people die, it's just that the media narrative is false as to who killed them. People may or may not have died here. I've seen no evidence of death, except the shooter himself, although no one's sure whether he killed himself or was shot by police. So that's just a very thumbnail sketch as to how ridiculous this narrative is. And if someone asked me, can they afford better actors? Which is a very good question. And I said, how come ISIS can't get better Photoshop people? There's a reason for this. When you plan something like this, when you create such an event, and it goes off without a hitch, you know, the days and years of planning and work and stage management that goes into this, you've got to feel a certain sense of satisfaction. And yet you can't tell anybody. You've pulled off the crime of the century, and no one is going to give you credit for it. Well, these people take credit for it by putting in the sometimes not so subtle pieces of evidence that it was artificial. Of course, this Western finance group, ridiculously called ISIS, inexplicably has billions of dollars, has a glossy magazine in perfect English, has an entire economy, fleets of oil tankers, and yet their Photoshop is so ridiculously stupid, it has to be done on purpose. How much can we get away with? Can we practically admit? I mean, it's an admission that it's fake. You have someone claiming to have, you know, he had to dig his own grave, and then they're going to shoot him and put him in it. So-called the Mossad spy that they found last year. I'm looking at this guy, and he has a perfectly clean orange jumpsuit, not a drop of sweat on him. The hole's already dug in the desert. And there is no sweat on this guy whatsoever. Now, clearly, they're going to notice this before they release it. Clearly, they're going to notice that, you know, it's ridiculous. Another example is the sniper from Denmark, the female. Every picture, her hair matches her uniform. She's always clean. Her boots are spotless. Her makeup is perfect in every picture. And yet they're claiming that she's in combat here, a sniper against ISIS. And I read 400, 500 responses on Facebook saying how wonderful she is, men and female, men and women alike. And I write, you're not noticing anything odd about here? Her chest pack for ammunition is empty. Her guns are perfectly clean. She's not even holding them right. Why is her makeup perfect? Why is her hair perfect? Why is she changing uniforms? Why are her boots clean? What army did she join? What training did she have? These people are incapable even of that level of cognition. I was blocked from this site, of course, by bringing this up. They have to believe the garbage. They have to believe the nonsense. They know it's nonsense. At least subconsciously, when you're looking at this ISIS picture of this Mossad agent digging a hole in the desert, and he looks perfectly calm with no sweat, no nothing on him, totally clean. Subconsciously, you're saying this is garbage. But you can't believe it. They put these crisis actors, whether it be for the pulse shooting or for this one, and they're bad, they're almost deliberately being bad. They're exaggerating. It's almost a parody, comedic. Of course they can get better actors. Of course they can make it far more plausible. But there's always any crime demands confession. So you have the element of people wanting to get, they're seeing how much they can get away with. They're rubbing your nose in it. And their power is increased every time they'll show a blatant falsehood and everyone buys it. Let me give you another example that I'm doing some work on now. The My Lai massacre. During the Tet Offensive. Very few people realize that Captain Medina and Lieutenant Kali were both acquitted. There was no My Lai massacre. But just like the Kent State issue, they needed an event to galvanize the public. They need a name. My Lai massacre. It's perfect. You have alliteration and everything. And the story, of course, is that a group of American infantry march into a village and for no reason begin killing men, women, and children. By the way, no man will ever kill a child on purpose. I'm sorry, I don't believe it. Most of these guys had families at home. A man, even a nut job, is not going to kill a child. I mean, a little child. In fact, no one is going to kill an innocent person. They might be mistaken and kill someone who they think is not innocent, someone they think is guilty. But no one would ever kill an innocent person. It doesn't even make sense, not even for a nut. The My Lai massacre was a way that the media was able to focus the public's attention. The American public was actually stubbornly in favor of the war. And it was broken by Seymour Hersh, a man whose career was doing very poorly at that time. He was just doing some peace work, you know, freelance work. And he admits himself that he needed something to break his career. Totally, you know, he was against the war, of course. He needed the story. There was no attempt to black out the news. The U.S. military or the media were talking about it practically as soon as it was discovered. There was no attempt to cover it up. The problem was the newspapers didn't think it was a genuine massacre. Hersh wrote in 1972 that we simply don't know how many Vietnamese citizens, listen to this, were killed as they huddled inside their bunkers during Bravo Company's march to the South. This kind of over-the-top rhetoric makes us suspicious right off the bat. The over-the-top rhetoric is one of the reasons it was probably rejected. My Lai galvanized the anti-war movement. Battle of Hue began in 1968, early 1968. Mass graves, of course, uncovered everywhere. They're in all ages and sexes. Throughout that battle, the ARVN, the Army of South Vietnam, released a list of about 4,000 victims. We don't know if they were combatants or not. We also know, though, that the Viet Cong slaughtered the political class of every village that they came to, the so-called Cultural Revolution. A guy by the name of Stanley Carnot, he says, balanced accounts have made it clear that the communist butchery at Hue did take place, perhaps on an even larger scale than reported during the war. The North Vietnamese political directorate says this. These are their orders for the occupation of South Vietnam. annihilate all spies, reactionaries, and foreign teachers, such as Americans or Germans in the area. Break open prisons, investigate cadre, soldiers and receptive civilians imprisoned by the enemy. Search for tyrants and reactionaries who are receiving treatment in hospitals. Motivate the people in the areas along the river to annihilate the enemy. This comes from the orders from the North Vietnamese political directorate to both NVA and Viet Cong forces when they hit South Vietnam. So it's a matter of policy. I love the phrase, motivate the people in the area. Motivate them to kill the enemy. Now, I've read this document in full, and it says that there's no evidence necessary. They're reactionaries. You'll know them right away. You'll know them just by looking at them. Captured Viet Cong documents said that they've eliminated thousands of people. We've annihilated members of various reactionary political parties, henchmen, and wicked tyrants. Another report from the Viet Cong sent to the Ho Chi Minh. They've killed exactly 2,867. Captured the Viet Cong report, which is mentioned by Peter McDonald's book on General Giap. We eliminated 1,892 administrative personnel, 38 policemen, and 790 tyrants. In other words, it was anybody who was pro-South in the area, pro-American or pro-ARVN. This was a matter of policy. The press did report on some of this, not very enthusiastically. This is one of the reasons that there was this pretty potent support for the war to stop these kind of killings. Seymour Hersh was going to kill two birds with one stone. He was going to focus attention away from this. He was going to galvanize and mobilize public opinion against the war. And, of course, launch his own personal career. And he did both of those things. Remember, too, the trial, Captain Medina, who was the commanding officer of this Charlie Company, is now infamous. Guys like Hugh Thompson were testifying because they were promised immunity. They knew they were in trouble. So the only option they had is go to prison for the rest of their lives or say that Captain Medina was an animal. Captain Medina admitted to one thing. He shot a Vietnamese woman in Viet Cong pajamas because he thought she had a grenade. Turns out he was wrong. And he was actually very, very broken up about that. Now, the Ma Lai massacre was first developed by the Viet Cong, who said that after Hugh, the U.S. forces had killed 500 people in the Son Mai village. And at Ma Lai. Seymour Hersh's appetite was whetted by this. The Viet Cong propaganda was now given a megaphone by Seymour Hersh, New York Times and Washington Post. The VC had to cover up their own crimes. And this is a foundation for the whole investigation. A VC radio broadcast said that a sweep operation was conducted 15th of March 1968. In this region, and the crazy Americans use light machine guns to kill, and all kinds of weapons to kill our innocent civilian people in the village of Son Mai. Including babies and pregnant women. Which makes no sense. They slaughtered everybody. This is what the Viet Cong, radio broadcast was saying right afterwards. Now, Colonel Henderson, who was Ernest Medina's commanding officer, issued him a medal after the battle. There was no question that they were fighting Viet Cong in the region. Once he realized that Medina was in trouble, he reversed himself and he said, the conscious massacre of defenseless babies, children and mothers, old men, in a kind of diabolical slow motion nightmare that went on for a better part of a day with a cold-blooded break for lunch. Colonel Henderson had just given a medal to these guys. The report said 128 VC and 22 civilians were killed during a fierce firefight. Now, I don't know how anyone can tell the difference between VC and a civilian. Helicopters were firing on Viet Cong positions surrounding the village. So there's no question they were there. We're not firing at nothing. But once the VC radio broadcast was heard, Seymour Hersh then gave his own personal independent investigation, which he calls himself. He submitted stories to Time and Newsweek, and they immediately ran the story of the American massacre on the strength of a picture of a bunch of bodies in front of a house. ABC, within days, said the U.S. committed genocide. The U.S. military began to panic. There was no evidence for a massacre. And one of the reasons for this is that there was no difference between a civilian and a soldier. It was a guerrilla war, and not all VC wore the pajamas. They didn't wear uniforms at all. They didn't have standardized command. They didn't have standardized weaponry. Members of Charlie Company were falling all over themselves, condemning Medina to save themselves. There was absolutely no shred of evidence here. Medina denied everything. The one thing that even Medina said, that somehow he could tell the difference between a combatant and a non-combatant. Women were combatants for the VC. Teenagers were combatants for the VC. Men and women in their 60s were combatants. This wasn't a regular army. Now, even if these guys are guilty of this, there was no protocol for guerrilla soldiers at the time. So as far as international law is concerned, they broke no law. However, in 1977, they drew up the rules of war for guerrillas, the Geneva Conventions, and it says, combatants are obligated to distinguish themselves from civilian populations while engaged in an attack or any military operation. Recognizing, however, that there are times in a conflict, the nature of hostilities, an armed combatant can't distinguish himself necessarily, but he will still retain his status as a combatant. In such situations, he carries his arms openly during each engagement, and that he has to show himself as a combatant, either in uniform or holding their weapons outward, even if he's not wearing a uniform. Therefore, the VC didn't listen to that. So even if the My Lai massacre took place, they broke no law. Even this addition to the Geneva Conventions wasn't operative at the time. There is no way to tell the difference between a combatant and a non-combatant in Vietnam. That would have been the case, of course, if the NVA invaded the area, because they wore uniforms. They had standardized weaponry. The Viet Cong did not. Every Vietnam veteran I've ever heard talks about teenagers, women, older folks, throwing grenades, shooting pistols. But there's even a bigger issue here. Like in all these police shootings we're talking about here, just like the Kent State shootings, the assumption is that these men are machines. These so-called non-combatants had been killing members of Charlie Company for the last year. They were cut to ribbons over the previous few months. A man who they loved, the sergeant, had his leg ripped off him by a landmine. They were angry. And they were frustrated. Because they had no idea who to take out their anger on. The Viet Cong didn't wear uniforms. Some did, some didn't. The Viet Cong were in that area, and they had opened fire on Charlie Company as they were approaching the village. We know this because the helicopter pilot, not Kelly, but there were several others, who were firing not at nothing, but at VC positions in the area. Now, even though there was tremendous and violent pressure on the military to convict, they did not. They did not. New York Magazine, certainly an ally of hers, said that Hirsch had deliberately inflated the numbers of dead. At a speech to Duke University, Hirsch says that he did lie. Callie was initially convicted, and he had that reversed, because in no way you can get a fair trial under those circumstances, and defense witnesses were not being subpoenaed properly. So both William Callie and Ernest Medina were acquitted. No one is going to shoot innocent people. They might be mistaken, but they don't knowingly shoot innocent people, and they will not shoot children under any circumstances. I refuse to believe. They may do that from the air. The American Air Force cowards do that. You really can't see them. But you're not going to put a gun to a child's head and blow their brain out. Maybe heavy drugs will do that, but it's simply not going to happen. I don't care how frustrated they are. Teenagers is another matter. So they were talking about children, but that could be a 17-year-old. Viet Cong came in all shapes and sizes. Therefore, it's impossible for there to be a massacre at My Lai. I talk about these things because all of these, whether it be hoaxes or false flags, have a lot in common. And we see this with the police shootings as well. That we're supposed to believe that these killings occurred for no reason. No one's going to voluntarily kill innocent people, especially when, as it was the case in Vietnam, a primary directive was to win the population over. The Viet Cong had slaughtered a lot of people. They were under orders to do so. Again, I don't think they shot children either. Maybe teenagers, but not babies. Nevertheless, they killed a lot of people who were unarmed. That was, in their case, part of their policy. They were ordered to do this. It was deliberate terror for the sake of motivating people to side with them. Terror was seen as a way to save lives. It's the old Tamerlane argument. If I go into a city and I slaughter every living creature there, that means other cities will be very quick to surrender and thus will save lives over time. Terror was used by the VC and the NVA explicitly as a tactic. Slaughter of civilians in World War II in Japan and Germany was used as a tactic to get the enemy to surrender unconditionally. This is not something that is done as a matter of policy in the U.S. In Vietnam. In fact, there was a tremendous amount of pressure on them not to do that, given how important public opinion was, both at home and there. The Tet Offensive, for example, was a victory for the U.S., but the American press depicted it as a total defeat, knowing that it was a lie. The RAND Corporation says this: the press gave the impression that the VC and the NVA had struck a successful blow against U.S. and ARVN forces. Some of you may know that in World War II, all pictures of dead Americans were banned. The first pictures of dead Americans were Marines at Iwo Jima in 1945. Prior to that, it was illegal. That was Life magazine, and they got into a lot of trouble for this. Don't quote me on this, but I think they won that battle. I don't mean the battle in Iwo Jima, that they were allowed to do this. But prior to that, no bodies were permitted. Well, in Vietnam, bodies of dead Americans were shown every night. I can't find a picture of a body in Vegas where every single person there had not only a camera, but a video camera. But somehow Time and Newsweek were running pictures of dead GIs all over the place. No one shoots innocent people knowingly. They may be mistaken, but no one shoots innocent people knowingly. No one is deliberately going to turn the population against them. But most importantly, and we see this in the Kent State shootings, they're men. The Viet Cong, not wearing uniforms, had cut that unit down to a quarter of its strength. They were told, coming into this village, that it was nothing but VC. That, in fact, they had removed the civilians. And therefore, anything you come across is VC. And I don't care what they look like. They won't be in uniforms, but everyone there will be VC. 20-year-old woman can very easily be a combatant. And they were. This is what they were told when they came into that village. They might not look like VC, but they are. The initial witness responses were that there was a firefight. That's where they got the medals from. Everyone agreed, including people like Kelly and the other helicopter pilots and crew, who then a few days later completely reversed their story. One of the worst aspects of the American judicial system, not saying a lot, is a notion of receiving immunity in exchange for testimony. I know in certain cases, like organized crime is a necessity. However, it does more damage than good it serves, because you now have an incentive to lie. Everyone surrounding Captain Medina was told, Medina is going to be the sacrificial lamb. We need you guys to send him up the river. You will not be punished or get a very minor punishment if you do this. No one served jail time. Not one person. Callie was in prison for a short time, but was released once his conviction was overturned. So no one served a sentence. Therefore, those who were condemning Medina were promised immunity. Therefore, nothing they say can be believed. But you go to any American history textbook, or Vietnamese war history textbook, and it'll talk about the My Lai Massacre. Charlie Company walks in there and starts slaughtering people. They will not tell you that every person there was acquitted under immense pressure for the opposite. But the testimony was bought. There was violent pressure. There were threats against these guys. You convict or else. And they found him innocent. They found him innocent because he was told that these people were VC'd, no matter what they looked like. The thing to keep in mind is everyone involved had changed their story the minute they found out that Medina was going to be offered up. Now, as far as Vietnam is concerned, you had the My Lai Massacre, which galvanized and focused attention against the war. People don't normally respond to abstractions. They need a solid object to focus on. So My Lai was what they created for the war in Vietnam. Kent State is what they created, domestically. Now, I mentioned Kent State in connection with Vegas, because sometimes people don't realize it takes quite a bit of shooting to kill someone, unless you hit them just right. One of the most ridiculous aspects of the story in Vegas was the distance from which this guy is shooting. They've never shot an AR-15 before. They've never shot before. Certainly media people have no idea what they're talking about. At 150 yards, with the ammunition he was using, only someone who's very good is going to be able to do much damage. By the time these bullets were falling harmlessly, by the time they hit the crowd, there may have been some wounded here or there. There was allegedly someone firing from the fourth floor. That would have made some more sense, I guess. But trained people. The National Guard, Kent State, was pushed up against a wrought iron fence. These are 18-year-old boys. Drugged up anti-war protests were going to kill them. Now, if you've ever seen video of Kent State, they never ever show the actual shooting, although video exists of it. It's always been the same standardized thing. You see the National Guard advancing, and then it cuts, then you hear gunshots, then it cuts back and their bodies. What shocks me is that this kind of blatant propaganda is accepted. To this very day, I got in trouble at my university jobs because I would not lecture on this. 20th century European history, I'm sorry. Where the Vietnam War comes up. And I would not say that these guys, for no reason, shot anti-war protesters. Now, personally, you slaughter them all. I don't give a damn. But that's not what these guys were there for. The very fact the National Guard was called in meant that it was so violent that the police couldn't handle it. The protesters weren't against the war. They were against being drafted. Because the minute the draft was eliminated in 71, the war protests dissipated. You have no substantial anti-war movement today, partially because it's in the service of Israel, but also because there is no draft. It's very abstract. Everyone who's there is extremely well paid. And everyone who's there signed up for this knowing that chances are they're going to end up in the Middle East or Central Asia. At the time, they were still being drafted. Drugs were tremendous at most of these protests, but certainly at Kent State. You had 18-year-old boys pushed up against a fence who finally, and they shot no more than 70 rounds. Four of these freaks were killed. After professionals with M16s fired at close range. Four. Now this guy fired a lot more rounds. He fired, 270 rounds very far away and killed 50 people. You had a situation here where Seymour Hersh wanted to destroy the war. And, you know, in attacking the Vietnam War, what they're really doing is saying that the war against Marxism is bad. The American establishment had come out against any anti-Marxism because so much of the American capitalist class was invested in the USSR. So from day one, the regime was trying to get out of a war in Vietnam. Or any war concerning the Cold War. Contrast that to today, where the very same establishment, a generation later, is talking about open war with Russia. But what's the difference? Why were they so violently opposed to war against the USSR, but are screaming their heads off for war with Vladimir Putin's Russia? It's because they supported left-wing dictatorship. They hate right-wing representative government, which is what you have here. Putin's popularity being 70%. It's never really dipped below that for very long. Fighting the Soviet Union was fighting Jewish interests at the time. Now that changed. It became fashionable again, to be against the USSR. If you remember the Jewish Defense League, was all in favor of the Vietnam War. Why? Well, their claim was that the Soviets were not permitting Jews to immigrate from Russia to Israel. Because of that, Irv Rubin was running around supporting the Vietnam War and fighting the anti-war protesters. And after that, most of the terrorist activity in America was directed against the USSR. Not because they're anti-communists, but because they were anti-Israel and that they were forbidding Soviet Jews to immigrate. That then became public policy, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, where there was going to be some sanctions on Russia never enforced unless they let Jews immigrate. Now, this problem doesn't exist in Putin's Russia. There's a big difference in that Putin has thrown the oligarchs in jail, introduced Orthodox faith in schools, uses bishops as advisors sometimes. A strongly Christian himself in the Orthodox way. Arms Hamas, helps arm Hezbollah and Iran. And is approached by Israel, not as a ruler, but as a suppliant. Israel goes to Russia humble. Israel comes to America like they're partners, like they own the place, like they walk into a Chinese restaurant. That's a big difference. Those who were disgusted at the treatment of American GIs coming home from Vietnam don't seem to have noticed that, although they're not draftees in this particular case, they're being worshipped as heroes now. Now, you guys know that I am no friend of the U.S. military. I am no friend of the swaggering cowards in the U.S. Air Force, especially. Especially the officer corps. But here I am defending the U.S. military in this particular case. And it's simply because a lot of these guys were GIs, not volunteers. Mid-level American Air Force officers are getting six figures and pay no taxes and get everything for free. They're not serving anyone but themselves. Especially in the Air Force, they're bombing targets that cannot shoot back, which is cowardly and phony. GIs are a different story. They're forced to go. They're grunts and considered, to say the very least, they're considered expendable. Very, very different story. But the most important notion is that the war against Iraq, the war against the Taliban, whichever faction you want to talk about, is a war that serves Israel's interests. Iraq never targeted the U.S., well, except to the extent that they supported Israel. But in and of itself, he had no problem with the U.S. There were no threats to each other. Iran is the same way. Hamas, Hezbollah. The only reason they give a damn about the U.S. is that in service to Israel, they have infidel troops on Islamic soil, and they're supporting Israel. They could create Israel and finance Israel. That, of course, is killing Muslims in Palestine. What I'm seeing so far, whether it be the Pulse shootings in Orlando, which I have an entire podcast on, Kent State massacre, my lie, Vegas, the church shooting of Dylan Roof, I'm taking these all together. They have a lot in common. Number one, they're focusing attention against something that the left wants destroyed, whether it be racism or the attack on Vietnam or gun control or whatever it might be. It's a leftist agenda here. Number two, somehow they create a circumstance where normal cognition has been short-circuited. Now, I've been dealing with people personally that are watching these crisis actors, laughing at how ridiculous it is, and then say, oh, but it's still all true. Facts don't seem to have any. There's a short circuit here. Therefore, number three, critical thought is gone. Number four, these guys are said to be shooting for no reason. Blind hatred. Or something else absurd like that. That doesn't make any sense for any man, let alone National Guard or an army at war or cops or whatever. All these moms, throwing these all in the same boat. Kent State, police shootings, all of this. No one is going to make their lives miserable by shooting an innocent person. People are going to shoot when they absolutely have to, when they're desperate. Otherwise, they're not going to shoot. Number five, media coverage of all of these has been extremely dogmatic very early. In all of these cases, they were shot for no reason. Vegas, you know, there's only one shooter. He had precisely this weapon. On and on and on. And, you know, the dogma comes out very early. When the towers came down on 9/11, within 10 minutes after the planes hit the tower, I was told that Osama bin Laden was behind it. How could they have known that? Osama bin Laden was the only group that didn't take credit for it. When any violent event occurs, every terrorist group in the world claims it's them. Had Osama bin Laden come out and said this was my doing, his stock would have soared in that part of the world. He refused. I didn't do it. Media dogmatism early shows an agenda. Even with the crisis actors, a lot of the things they say over and over again when they can't possibly know each other, that they were loading bodies up on trucks, is a big one. That they were heroes, that they all went back into the line of fire to rescue people, that the guns sounded like firecrackers. There's one of these crisis actors, I don't know if many of you have seen him. It's a tall, skinny white guy with no shirt. He's asked about what happened, and he says, "We're all Americans here. We're all fighting for the same cause, for peace and justice." I asked you what happened at the shooting. "Well, it was really bad. We're all Americans here fighting for the same cause." It's like he jumped on a soapbox here. Very calm, very cool, no shaking, no sweating. Every one of these guys, physically attractive, men, women, older, whatever it is, they're all okay. None of them are ugly. They all very easily could be struggling actors. Many of whom are, you know, this is not the first time. We've seen most of these people before. The heroism motif, I mean, you could say is self-interest. But it's odd that how they did that, loading bodies on, no one's ever seen a truck, by the way. And finally, the last thing they all have in common is the lack of context. You could show a picture of a hut somewhere in Southeast Asia, have a bunch of bodies on top of it, put it in Time magazine and say, or in front of it, I should say, and have a caption that reads, USGI slaughtered these people for no good reason, and an anti-communist frenzy. And people are going to believe it. And this is the final concept I want to talk about. Why do intelligent people refuse to believe the obvious truths here? We've all been in debates, I certainly have been, where I rattle off fact after fact after fact after fact. I explain where my sources come from. I explain my own expertise. I explain that these facts are not at issue. Everyone agrees with them. And they'll still disagree, and I will see them a week later, a month later, with their same position that they now know is false. Why is this? I said it before, and I'll say it again. One of the most difficult aspects of my career is the fact that I obsess about my sources and accuracy and logic and facts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But then I have to go out into the world and realize that no one else does that. Truth is not important. Truth is just an abstraction to most people. The reason why they have to believe the government narrative is this. If they even give in a little bit that it's a hoax or that people did die, but that the FBI or some other group like that was in on it or was an inside job or something like that, what does that entail? It means that everything that they thought they knew up until that point is false. It means they can no longer show any allegiance to the present social system. It means they've been lied to their whole lives. Their lifestyle is going to have to change. Well, if this is false, what else is? They're looking at, well, what is going to amount to an unhappy life. Many of us lead because, you know, talking like this does not make us popular. They're going to have to jettison everything they thought they knew. None of that's in their interest. Their worldview is going to have to change. Their behavior, even their social circles, all going to have to be turned upside down if they come to realize this. Nothing will ever be the same again. For that reason, they have to believe it. You need to be patient with these people. No, you want to strangle them. That's how it. We need to keep our cool. That eventually we will break through. And if they're that stupid that they won't break through, well, then we don't. Then they're not good enough anyway. They're not intelligent. They won't do any damage anyway. These are the same people who would agree with us if we had the power to do this. So again, I ask my friends to contribute to this show, not just because I have struggling financially for the first time in a long time, but that I do this full time. I've lost several university jobs due to purely ideological concerns, and it's always a struggle for me. I do this full time. I couldn't do anything else if I tried, full time or part time. This is what I'm meant to do, and I'm extremely good at what I do. So many people are plagiarizing my stuff. Apparently, I'm very good at what I do. But I couldn't be this good unless I was full time. Please keep me that way. I beg of you to please keep me that way. I want very little. Books, medical bills, the occasional meal. I don't eat very much. Cooking is a big pain in the neck. I want very little. You give me a penny, that penny is going to where you think it's going to go to. It's going to go to allow me to do the research that I've spent my life, dedicated the last 27 years in doing. Anyway, thank you. Whether you contribute or not, thank you very much. To my friends, thank you. And to my enemies, stupid though you are, you do keep me on my toes. And I thank you guys as well. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.